Let not your heart be troubled. You are listening to the Sean Hannity Radio Show podcast.
So like many of you, I have trouble sleeping. I have insomnia. No matter what I tried, it wouldn't work until I met Mike Lindell and I got my very own MyPillow. It has changed my life. What makes MyPillow so different is MyPillow's patented adjustable fill. In other words, you can adjust the patented fill to your exact individual needs so you get the support you need and want to help you get to sleep faster and stay asleep longer. Just go to MyPillow.com or call 1-800-919-6090. Remember, use the promo code Hannity. When you do, Mike Lindell will give you his best offer ever. Buy one pillow and get another one absolutely free. MyPillow, made in the USA, 10-year unconditional warranty, and it has a 60-day no-questions-asked money-back guarantee. You have nothing to lose. So it's time for you to start getting the quality of sleep that you've been wanting and we need. Just go to MyPillow.com or call 800-919-6090. Promo code Hannity. Take advantage of Mike's special two-for-one offer. MyPillow.com, promo code Hannity.
Hello, everyone. This is the Sean Hannity Show. My name is Burgess Owens, and I have the honor of being your host today. I want to first of all thank Sean and his awesome team for the opportunity to sit behind his mic. First of all, let me say it is so good being back in New York during this Christmas season. I spent many years here as a New Yorker doing my days as a New York Jet, and a few years after retirement from the Al Davis Oakland Raiders, and it's a very, very special city during this time of year with a special feeling and energy. Let's start off by first of all giving you our number. It's 1-800-941-SEAN. Or 1-800-941-7326. And before I jump into the show, let me also take a minute to let you know where you can find me on social media. My website is www.BurgessOwensTalks, it's plural, talks.com. Twitter is Burgess Owens at Burgess Owens. Facebook is Burgess Owens at Officially Burgess Owens. And I'll co-host a weekly radio show with Rick Trader called the Conservative Commandos Radio Show. We discuss topics of the day. I also have a must-read Christmas gift. Not too late, guys. An Amazon bestseller, Liberalism, or How to Turn Good Men into Whiners, Weenies, and Wimps. Okay, gang, we have an awesome lineup of guests that will be joining us for the next 3 hours. These are men and women who I have tremendous amount of respect for. They've been my heroes for a long time. Can't wait to share our conversations with you. The Dr. Alveda King, Jennifer Carroll, who's a former lieutenant governor for the state of Florida. Jennifer, by the way, is the first Black American in the history of my home state to serve in that position. We have Colonel Alan West, Sheriff David Clark, Clark Kellogg, who's a former NBA star with the Pacers and presently a sports commentator. I can promise you, my friends, that our conversation will be both educational and enlightening, so stay tuned and hold on to your hat. As a quick background, let me kind of give you an idea of what drives my why. You know, why is it that I have a love for our country? Why is it that I'm a stand up and man up for our flag kind of guy? And why I'm a conservative with a capital C? Well, I was extremely blessed to grow up in the Deep South, 1960s, segregated South in Tallahassee, Florida. It was the days of Jim Crow laws, the KKK, the tearing down of the walls of segregation. And I grew up in the shadows of the Florida A&M University, where I saw success everywhere. Academia, entrepreneurs, teachers, coaches, committed mothers, and visionary fathers. It was where marriage was expected and divorce was very rare. The message was very simple. You can achieve anything in this country if you work hard and willing to overcome and never, never quit. The message regarding racism, you can beat it by winning, whether it be in the classroom, on a debate team, or in a sports arena. Their message about regarding respect, you can't demand it, but you can command it, again, by winning. The most important message to define our segregated community as young men was we were taught to respect and protect womanhood. Only whiners, weenies, wimps, and cowards do not respect and protect womanhood. We're also taught to respect our family name, our flag, and our country. When I left Tallahassee to go play football, I went down to the University of Miami. There I was an All-American defensive back. I graduated with a degree in biology, a minor in chemistry. I was a first-round draft choice to the Jets, where I played for 7 years, traded to the Raiders, where I played for 3, and won Super Bowl 15 with the just-win-baby Oakland Raiders. Since 1983, I've been in corporate sales and an entrepreneur. I'm now an executive director for the Utah chapter of an organization called One Heart Project. It's a nationwide initiative that's helping thousands of forgotten youth, those that are coming out of the juvenile correction system, needing directions and opportunity. These young boys are looking for hope and a second chance, and unfortunately for far too many, it'll be their first chance. So I'm very excited about that initiative. Okay, so the theme of the day, the state of the Black community and what it'll take to make it great again. Now, our conversation begins with a premise, and that is, it was once great. Yes, for those who have been taught in our progressive public school system, the black community, believe it or not, was once great. I know it because I lived in one. And let me say why this conversation is important to all Americans, regardless of race, creed, or color. The journey of the black community over the last 100 years can serve as a warning beacon to help understand the true nature of the enemy that we are now facing. It's an enemy that's targeted the black community since 1910. It's an enemy that's stolen and demeaned our black American history. It's evil, cowardly, destructive, empathy-free, and it uses stealth, deceit, and betrayal. That enemy is the ideology of socialism, Marxism, liberalism, and atheism that's attacked our institution for decades, and it's been undermining our Judeo-Christian foundation. Our fight today in 2017 is not racism. It's socialism, Marxism, liberalism, and atheism, which uses race to divide us. Now, do we have racists among us? Absolutely. And we will always have individual racists, black and white, because some people choose the spirit of hate. But they have no power over free and educated people. The KKK in 2017 has no power over the black community. Institutional racism, on the other hand, is a different story. It is absolutely dead. Proof, a two-term black president, black millionaires throughout our country, in every segment of our society in which they compete, black Americans in the seat of power, in city mayors, police chiefs, United States attorney generals, secretary of states. It is now time to expose the big lie. And that is the successful indoctrination in the false perception of black Americans for the last 60 years. It is a false perception by the left that's been accepted by both blacks and whites. And that perception is that the black community was a hapless and oppressed race in slavery, waiting for white Americans to allow us to integrate with them and to vote. The reference of the black community as an oppressed and dominated race by white people is the greatest insult to black Americans for every generation who's paid the price, sacrificed, and contributed to our country to make it the greatest in the history of mankind. It is a lie, but it's also very effective. It allows white elitists to feel powerful and superior. It allows dependent blacks to feel victimized and entitled. The message from our past great generations are very different and very simple. We have a choice. We can either be pitied or be respected. It is absolutely impossible to be both. My ancestors chose respect, and so do I. There's a very insightful quote by Karl Marx in the 1980s, a father of socialism, Marxism, the author of the Communist Manifesto. He said the first battleground is the rewriting of history. So let's talk a little bit about history. Where were we and where are we now? Matter of fact, let's start a little bit of my history, my beginnings as an American. It started in 1848 with the arrival of my great-great-grandfather, Silas Burgess, in the belly of a slave ship. He and his mother were sold on an auction block in Charleston, South Carolina, to the Burgess Plantation. Silas was orphaned by 8 years old, but with the help of older slaves, escaped to Texas via the southern route of the Underground Railroad. That route went all the way to Texas and Mexico and facilitated by German and Mexican Americans. Silas made his way to Texas, where he became a successful entrepreneur, a pillar of his community. He owned over 100 acres of land, which was paid off in 2 years. He was a committed father who understood the power of education. He founded the first black elementary school in his area, the first black church in his region. He was also a politically engaged member of the Republican Party and a very proud American. The greatest compliment, though, given to my great-great-grandfather can be summed in two words: fiercely independent. So what is the message that comes from a slave that within decades was living his American dream? That America is a place of second chances, is a place of unlimited dreams, is a place where your beginning does not determine your end. You do. We do. Our success is determined by our choices. And here in America, we can fail and fail and fail again and still have the freedom to man up, stand up, and start anew. And that, my friend, defines the American way. It defines the black community that within only 50 years after slavery, remember, it was illegal to teach slaves to read and write. But once free, they taught themselves. They moved forward, and they kicked butt. It was the black Americans in 1900 that created the first national business network, successful black men and women, entrepreneurs from New York to San Francisco. President Theodore Roosevelt was the featured speaker at the first national convention. It was a black woman, C.J. Walker, in 1915 that became the first female self-made millionaire in this country. After World War II, it was black Americans that led our country in the percentage of entrepreneurs. We led our country in the growth of the middle class. We led our country in terms of the commitment of men committed to higher education. We led our country in terms of the percentage of men committed to marriage. And here was found the strongest family unit in our country, the black community. So where do we stand? And what are the numbers I'm going to share with you in the next few minutes are pretty daunting. And it can lead to only one of two conclusions. The first conclusion is that it's natural. It's a black thing. It is, after all, black people think and act without skin, and this should be accepted and expected. The other is it's unnatural that the black community has been strategically targeted for decades and that the black misery has been used as a get-out-the-vote political strategy. So here we go, and please pay attention to these numbers. 83% of black teen men, 83% of black teen boys are unemployed today. 93% in the great liberal city of Chicago. 70% of black men abandon their children with no shame. We had an all-time low, 3.8% of entrepreneurs today versus the 40% when I was growing up in Tallahassee. 75% of black boys in California today, this came out June of this year, cannot pass standard reading and writing tests. It's apparent that some things don't change with those old rascally Democrats, the same party that originally passed laws against educating their slaves. 1,800 black children every single day are sacrificed to the abortion industry, mostly urban urban mothers. What does this equate to? Close to 700,000 poor black mothers who have been indoctrinated, radicalized to think that their babies are no more than disposable trash. Now, how does this happen? Well, unfortunately, we have within our community a group of black Americans who I call the royalty class black elitists. They represent about 30% of our population. They're socialists. And they see these numbers, and they could care less. They simply don't care. So you see, it has nothing to do with them. They're living the American dream. Their own dear children are already going to great schools. They live in nice, safe neighborhoods. They already network with the rich and the famous. And they could care less about the poor. They prioritize their ideology and their party over the welfare of their own race. And will vote with no shame, no empathy, for every anti-black policy that their white Democratic leaders will demand of them. Now, there's good news, and that good news is that about 30% of black Americans who feel the way I do. We hold conservative values. We love our children. We love our race. We love our country and our God. And we're waking up to the power of political free agency. In the coming years, there'll be 15, 20, 25% of conservative black Americans who will be voting values and principles first over party. We will never again allow the Democrats to herd our race like cattle into a predictable 93% groupthink. The days of using misery as a political strategy will end, and respect from both parties will begin. And I can promise you this, America, that as we pull our country back, pull our community back from the evil abyss of socialism, we'll also pull back our nation. Okay, friends, I think we're going to look at taking our first break. We're on the other side of this, we're going to be coming back with Alveda King. She's a real game changer, the niece of Martin Luther King Jr., and someone I'm so excited about talking with. So hold tight until the other side of the break. Hello, gang. We're back again. This is Burgess Owens, a former NFL player. And let me give you our number here with Sean Hannity Show so you'll know who to call into with the numbers to get to us. It's 1-800-941-SEAN or 1-800-941-7326. So we're going to take a couple minutes and take some calls. I'm going to go to Rob out in Long Island, New York.
Hi, Bertus.
Hey, Rob. How you doing, buddy?
Okay. I appreciate your topic. You know, as a young man, all of my heroes in life were African-American men. I wanted to be a jazz pianist, and I studied and watched the master virtuoso pianists of Oscar Peterson and McCoy Tyner and Ramsey Lewis. And my parents are very involved in the civil rights movement, and a topic I think is huge, and I think I wish Trump would really dig into this now, is the control of the public sector teachers unions over the school districts that systematically deny African-American folks, especially a couple of examples. 2 years ago, Questlove, the drummer for the Jimmy Fallon band, with 20,000 African-American protesters were protesting the closing of these charter schools, in which they were showing that the young girls, with security and order, they were beating the white Jewish kids in Scarsdale, New York, in math and science. Presently, 44,000 African-American families are online for 3,000 openings for charter schools in Brooklyn. I think that you've probably seen the movie Waiting for Superman about how these 114,000 African-American families online, back to 2009.
Yeah.
And this, to me, is a huge issue.
Okay. Let me answer that. You have a point, and what I want the audience to know is this fight we've been having has been going on for quite a while, guys. It's not just overnight. For those who don't know, the father of public education, progressive education, is John Dewey back in the early 1900s. John Dewey was an atheist. He's a socialist. And he's obviously the thing I just mentioned earlier about education. The first battleground is the rewriting of history. That's what socialists do. So the goal here, if you look at what the public school system is doing and the reason why we have black kids, poor black kids, not being able to escape it, is because when you dumb down our kids, they become Democrats. They become dependent. They become angry. They become controllable. And those are the things we have to be careful about. So, yes, that's a fight. And that's why everyone here should be voting and vote only, guys, for people who give our kids and our parents a choice of education, because that's what every child should have as a chance to think themselves out of the box and into freedom. Okay, let's move on to let's go Ryan. Ryan, have a comment there, buddy?
Hey, Merry Christmas to everybody.
Thank you, Ryan.
You betcha. Hey, I just wanted to say, first of all, I've listened to you numerous times in various venues, and I really appreciate everything you've had to say. You seem to be a man of a kind heart and really an intelligent individual who really puts forth truth, and you stand for it, and I want to say thank you very much. You kind of remind me of Solomon Chase back in the day, his day.
We have a heartbreak coming up, buddy. So you have a question?
Vote for you any day.
Thank you so much. Well, keep this in mind, guys. We all have our place in this life. Mine is to be an entrepreneur and to let everyone know, particularly our kids, that if I can do it, you can do it too. That is what America is all about, guys. Every generation has done it in the past, and we have to make sure we continue that moving forward. So stay tuned to we get on the other side with Dr. Alveda King. I look forward to it. Here comes. Hello, everyone. This is, again, the Sean Hannity Show. My name is Burgess Owens. I'm sitting in for Sean, former NFL player with the Jets and the Raiders, now part of the Let's Make America Great Again team. So for all my teammates out there across the country, welcome. Okay, let's get started. I'm looking forward to having everybody to listen in on our next speaker. Our next guest will be Alveda King. Alveda is Martin Luther King's Jr.'s niece and director of civil rights for the unborn, African-American outreach for Peace for Life, and someone I have had respect for years. She's a true champion, a very courageous soul, and I look forward to having you guys get a chance to listen to a little bit of her thoughts. Alveda?
Yes, I'm right here.
Hi, how you doing?
Beautiful opportunity. I'm glad. I'm good, and I'm glad I'm in D.C., and I'm headed for a White House tour at Christmas, so I'm not going to be able to stay with you too long, okay. But I'm so glad to join you.
Well, let's make sure you tell the president hello from all of us here, okay? So listen, I'll jump right into it. There's something that for those of us who care about what's happened to our race, particularly in the abortion arena, abortion has been a devastating impact on us. 20 million babies killed since 1973, which is about, by the way, 40% of our present population. I wanted to ask about a link between abortion and breast cancer, and there's a bunch of studies out there. I just want to highlight two of them. One was published by the Journal of National Medical Association, and since 80% of black Planned Parenthood abortion centers are in the black community. I thought I'd bring this one up first. Black women at the age of 50 and above who have had at least one induced abortion have an increase of breast cancer of 370%. There's another one. There's a 2013 study by the Breast Cancer Prevention Institution fact sheet that states that 54 out of 75 worldwide studies show there's an increase of breast cancer with those who've got an abortion. 19 out of 24 studies here in the United States have also shown the same increase. Now, there has been another, on the other side, a study released in 2007 by Karen Michaels that mentions that there's absolutely no connection whatsoever between cancer and abortion. Let me just ask you this. First of all, is it just me, or are these decades of studies just been unreported? Because I had really not had a chance to hear this before now.
Let me have a minute on that. when you say our race, there's only one race. I learned that from my dad, Reverend A.D. King, my uncle, Dr. Martin Luther King, Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., my granddaddy, Reverend A. Martin Luther King Sr. So I was taught Acts 17:26 of one blood, God made all people. So we're one race, but we're different ethnicities. But now every statistic that you just quoted is true. It's verifiable in the African-American community. And as a matter of fact, we had the DNA test in my family, and we are part African, part Irish, part Native American. So that, and that's verifiable as well. But African Americans were targeted by Margaret Sanger, the founder of Planned Parenthood. And at the time, we were called Negroes, and Planned Parenthood started out as the Birth Control League with the Negro Project. The Negro Project specifically targeted African Americans, other minorities, and poor, what Margaret Sanger wrote to be useless eaters. She said, colored people are like weeds. They need to be exterminated. We don't want that word to get out, so let's cultivate some of their leaders. Now, the products and chemicals of abortion and abortive fascists, chemical birth control and birth control devices, that means the shots, the pills, the IUDs, and all of that, and the abortions themselves are definitely associated with breast cancer. Because if you introduce any of those agents into the body of a woman, her body will respond and reject it. Abortion interrupts the cycle when the breasts are being developed to feed the baby the milk. The same thing happens when you cut off the process. So there is a high rate of breast cancer that is associated with abortion. It's higher in the black community because Planned Parenthood, under the guise and leadership of Margaret Sanger, targeted the black ethnic community to try to do what was called population control. So everything you said is very accurate.
And could I add to that, 80%, gang, 80% of abortion centers are set up in minority communities. So it appears then it's not just the black babies that are being targeted, it's also black mothers who end up paying the price. And I'm going to ask you another question, but it seems to me that the tobacco industry paid a big price by not giving out all the information about potential downside. And I would love to see a day when we have a warning label on the side of abortion centers that this could be something that mothers should at least know about so they can make that choice.
Well, one thing that President Trump had said, because when he really found out what abortion was, he did what I did in 1983. Prior to 1983, I was pro-choice. Mm-hmm. And I would say a woman has a right to do abortions and all that. I had secret abortions myself. But when I found out what abortion was and that it was killing a human being in the womb of a woman, in the womb of a mother, without the baby having a say-so or a lawyer, that was too close to slavery for me. So when I was born again in 83, I also received Jesus Christ as my Lord and Savior and became a voice and an advocate for life from the womb to the tomb. That means the baby, the poor people, the sick people, the elderly people, people who are unjustly incarcerated. And so President Trump, when he looked at abortion and said, my God, you rip little babies out of the womb of their mothers and tear them apart, he said, that's wrong. That's evil. And he said, when I'm elected, we'll stop. So he gave us the Mexico City policy, a pro-life justice in Justice Gorsuch, and many other things that he is doing to correct that. So it's really time for America across the board to repent, like I had to do, and to say it was wrong to kill those little babies. And I have had the problems in my own body. Some of the issues that you're discussing, I just was treated for cervical cancer many years ago and was healed, thank God. Mm-hmm. And I had some problems with my breast and all that, but the Lord was very gracious and merciful to me. So we just need to repent in America. And I know it'll take longer than we have today to verify your facts, but your facts are 200% accurate, except don't call us our race and your race. Mm-hmm. We've got to reconcile to God and say, Lord, we made a mistake. We thought we were different races. We're different nations, every nation, every tongue, every tribe, yes, but we're the human race. And so we need to repent and get it right in America.
Very good. And there's one other thing I wanted to make sure we cover. A lot of Americans probably are not aware of the Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act of mm-hmm. September 5th, 2015. Yes. Why don't we talk about that? Because I want America to understand who stands for the black community and who stands against it, including black congressmen who seem to think that it's okay to do what you're going to explain in the next few minutes. So please explain that to America so we understand what that Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act is.
Well, people don't even remember when President Obama was Senator Obama.
Yep.
He said, no, if a baby is born alive, you need to go ahead and kill it because the intent was to kill it in the first place in the womb. And if that didn't work, let the baby die. Don't give it medical treatment. That's it. All was going on when he was running for president and became president. And so there was a lot of resistance to any legislation for all of his 8 years, and there's still some resistance now saying that, because what we're saying is when a baby is born, now there's a governor, it came across my desk either yesterday or this morning, and the governor says, no, we're not going to protect that little baby who survives abortion because the intent was to kill the baby, and that would cut back on a woman's right to choose. And so that still exists today. But if a baby is born alive, they just lay the baby up to the side and let the baby die. And that's wrong. So that baby is a patient, a human being. The baby was already a human being in the womb, but definitely when the baby's born, everybody could see the baby, and the baby needs treatment. So I think that's very inhumane to deny those babies medical assistance.
I'm going to take it a step further. It's more than inhumane. It's called infanticide. It's what happens when babies are killed, period. And I hope America understands what's happening here with this progressive movement. It's first of all, there's no God in the middle of it. So people who do this, including our black congressional congressmen, every single one of them, 100%, I should say 100%, because Mia Love, my good friend out in Utah, voted for this protection. But every single black congressman, John Lewis, Elijah Cummings, Maxine Waters, they understand what's going on. They understand the targeting. They understand these are alive babies being killed, and they still can move forward.
They're in the pocket of the abortion lobby, and they're receiving grants and monies and awards from Margaret Sanger to make their leaders. They did scholarships and political contributions and all kinds of things to our best and our brightest. So the people were elected and then found out that they were in a trap and didn't know how to get out of it. So they feel, black people, we are very loyal people. So if you do something for us, we feel like we're obligated to serve you. But they're serving death. They're not serving life. And something there again, we need revival. We just need to wake up, repent.
Well, I tell you, I just want to ask you real quickly, because obviously with your connection, you're the niece of Martin Luther King Jr. and your grandfather. You were there to know him a little bit. Would they side with today's political black leaders? By the way, I'm going to introduce something real quickly, because leadership to me is a willingness to take the tough blows, to sacrifice self, to be able to have a vision. I think we have a bunch of fake black leaders, John Lewis, Elijah Cummings, Maxine Waters. Every single policy, particularly when it comes down to life of our race and protection and vision, they seem to stand
it
against
again.
It.
You said our race.
Yes, I know.
There's only one race.
I'm totally with you on that. Yes, for sure.
I have to remind you, so
okay.
I agree with that, but go ahead.
So, I make that difference only because, again, we both grew up in the same time down south, and we remember the courage, we remember the tenacity that our parents had to make sure they were respected and make sure they got the respect, commanded respect from others. And so there's something that's happened over the last 6 years to our race that's really
our ethnic community. Go ahead.
Yes,
please.
Yes. And that difference is something we have to make sure we're addressing, because at the end of the day, by us helping those who've been targeted, the black community, then we actually help our country come back much stronger, because we're going to start voting our values, our country values, the way Americans always done in the past. And with that being said, we're going to have not only black children being protected, but also white children and every other child who deserves life will be protected. So, let me just ask you one other question. We'll let you go. I know you have something to do there. What do you see? What is the way that we can bring our community back to being the great community that we all grew up in, pride, and all the things that we saw with our parents?
Well, we have to return to God, and you can read about this in all of my books, King Truths, King Rules, even my cookbook, Gigi's Home for the Holidays, has some of these same principles in there. Return to God, repent, accept that we are one human race with ethnic distinctions, and that we can do what my uncle said we're going to have to do. Uncle M.L., Martin Luther King, said we must learn to live together as brothers and as sisters or perish as fools. Well, we can't do that if we keep seeing ourselves as separate races and separate this and separate that. We are a people in need of the Lord, and that's why I am Evangelist Alveda King. So we have to return to God, to repent, to embrace each other as brothers and sisters, not as separate races. But we can't be colorblind, or else we need glasses. So we know that our skin color denotes ethnic distinctions, which are beautiful, but they're not designed by God to divide us, but to unite us. So as long as we remember that and stop killing the poor, the sick, the elderly, and the babies in the womb, and stop unjustly incarcerating people to make money, then God will begin to hear our prayer.
Alveda, you just described the American way, and I can't say that enough. What makes us unique is our Judeo-Christian values, our foundation, which allows us, number one, to be open to everything and everyone, but most importantly, allows us to see each other the way God does, inside out, not versus outside in. So I'm spot on. I think as we continue, every generation has done much better. We now have to just kind of make up for what's been happening the last 8 years. We kind of took a little bit of a step back, but we're going to come back strong again. So, Alveda, thank you so much. We're going to take a quick break here, and on the other side, just maybe ask a couple questions. And Alveda, enjoy yourself. Have a merry, merry Christmas, and hail to the president for us, okay? Hello, gang. This is Burgess Owens, again, for Sean Hannity. Let me give you real quick the numbers here. It's 1-800-941-SEAN or 1-800-941-7326. We're going to be heading off to a heartbreak in a minute, so let me just answer one of the questions I'm seeing here from Tavares, and that is, what is my take on the criminal justice system, and is it fair to black Americans? Personally, I think we need to take a good long look at that. I'm running into and seeing the frustration that comes from our juvenile system, in which young men who have no fathers, have no direction, but they make a mistake, and then there's no way for them to get out of it. They have this record. They can't get a job when they come out. It is amazing, again, the hopelessness, and that's why we have such a strong return back to the system, because we're not giving these kids hope. So we need to definitely take a look at this, find ways, and I think the trade should be a good way to get some of our folks, some of these young men and women who really want to make a break and change their lives. They need to have a way to get out and work a good hard day's work, get paid, take care of their families, understand what it is to be self-sufficient. And getting jobs in the trades will probably do it. From what I'm understanding in Utah, where I'm from, now that a lot of illegals are going back home, it's increasing the job market for those of us here in this country. And I'm hoping that we take advantage of that, help our young people to learn the trade, get and do things that they have not done before, and we'll end up solving this. We'll see you back on the other side of the break, guys. Hey, gang. Welcome once again. This is the Sean Hannity Show. My name is Burgess Owens, former NFL player, and again, one of your teammates now. And let's make America great again. I'm going to be introducing someone I have a lot of respect for. I'm actually going to do a little bit of a deep dive into her accomplishments, because I think it's important as we kind of talk through the next few minutes to get an idea there's a message that comes from past generations that we have to make sure we grab again and push forward. First of all, I mentioned that General Carroll is the first black lieutenant governor for the state of Florida. Her parents immigrated to America from Trinidad when she was 8. She enlisted to the United States Navy, where she, after 20 years, retired as a lieutenant commander. She was a state legislator for 7 years, small business owner, executive director of the Florida Department of Veterans Affairs. Her son is in the NFL. She's been married for over 30 years and just appointed to a position by President Trump that you might want to tell us a little bit about. But I'll tell you, this could have gone in so many different ways because of her background, but I'll just say this. It represents what my parents' generation expected from us, and we just need to have more of those higher expectations and more success. So with that being said, Jennifer, how you doing?
I am great, Burgess. You're doing a wonderful job standing in for Hannity. He better watch out. He may take over here.
No concerns on that piece, believe me. So listen.
The NFL got a couple open spots. ESPN got a couple open spots. You ought to go over there.
Well, listen, I wanted to do this with you. Because I think it'll be great for our audience to hear a little bit from black conservatives who've kind of paid the price, who've gone through the American dream, and appears that everything just kind of worked out, that we give maybe some life lessons or principles that we learned from our parents. And I'm going to trade off back and forth with you. We'll take a few minutes, and of course, we're going to run out of time. But I think Americans can learn a lot from just knowing how this works out for everyone, not just us, but everyone out there who's trying to succeed. So do you have a few life lessons? And what I'll do is, once you give yours, I'll share one of mine, okay? We'll go back and forth.
Well, sure. As you mentioned, I'm an immigrant born in Trinidad, West Indies, and my parents were my adopted parents who brought me up to the United States. So coming to the United States and assimilating into the culture and working hard, they came here for the opportunities. And my father, one time as a teenager, I felt like I had to please everybody. And I went to him crying one day, and I was just so distraught that I just couldn't please the people that I was trying to please. And my father said, "You'll never be able to please everyone, so don't beat yourself up. What you can do is the best that you can do." And what he was trying to say is that at the end of the day, it's not up to me to make sure everyone is pleased, and we'll never have a perfect anything, a perfect people, perfect society, but what we can do is our best. And my mother, you know, she was a wise woman above her means, and one of the sayings she used to tell me is that stay on top of the world because it's too crowded on the bottom. And what she was saying is that people love misery. Misery loves company, and everybody will try to pull you down or find fault with others and wallow in the negative. So her words were saying to me to keep my head up and don't get dragged down into the bottom where the majority is. And I think that's what a couple of those lessons there, President Trump himself is recognizing and realizing and staying above the fray and staying ahead of things so that no matter what people call him, no matter what people say, that he's going to stay steadfast to do what's right.
Exactly. Let me share one with my mother. Again, wise person. And I was one of four black athletes that actually was integrating this white high school in Tallahassee, Florida. So my sophomore year, I remember standing in the kitchen. I was probably complaining or maybe getting a little angry about what was going on. And she said something that was so powerful. And I really hope people really take the time to listen to this. Very, very simple, but very powerful. She says, "Burgie, just remember not to let other people's problem become yours." Now, that little bit of saying was basically saying this: don't let racists turn you into one. And I love that, because over time, what you realize is that we can control our future if we understand who we are and not let the anger of somebody else. I mean, the worst thing that can happen in our life is to turn into an angry person who looks at other people, do not like them, and we have to live with ourselves forever with that deal. So it's a great lesson. Do you have another one you want to share with us?
Well, you know, the thing about it, and that's what we're seeing of late, that the term racism is just thrown out there for everything, and it's just so it could be manipulated. But one of the things that we talked about making the black community great again, and President Trump is talking about making America great again, that's for everybody. But the black community throughout the years have been so somewhat accustomed now to having everything on the bottom of education, the bottom of the social ills in a community. And the black community must get out of the mental shackles that the Democrats have placed them in. And the conversations that we will have with our Democrats, black Republicans and black Democrats, we agree on almost all the issues: family values, work ethic, economic empowerment, less government regulations, all the things that are conservative values. But yet when they go to vote, they're voting on the racism and what the other people are trying to instill in their minds as to why they cannot come out of this enshackled mentality. But black community, they get engaged and start marching and having these riots and making excuses for things like my kid has ADD or I come from a single family home and subsidized tests, the standardized tests need to be dumbed down because I can't learn. And those things were not, from my parents' generation and my grandparents' generation, was not those things that were instilled in us. It was that we could be empowered to do for ourselves. You'd have to pull yourself up by the bootstraps. Look at people like Frederick Douglass, who worked hard to promote literacy among blacks. George Washington Carver invented 400 products from the peanuts, and many of these people were either enslaved or were one generation removed from slavery, but they did not let the lack of freedom and the education that we know it today to stop them from learning. Benjamin Banneker, right there in Washington, D.C., our nation's capital, he recreated all of the blueprints for creating the layout of Washington, D.C. from memory when the French planner, Lafont, he left and took all of his plans. So we have to really pull our look within and see the self-worth that we have and understand and recognize that excuses should not be in our vocabulary for precluding us from moving forward.
Well, I tell you, it's all about expectations, and that's so spot on. I as you were talking, I was remembering back in the 60s, I was in seventh grade, and I was actually demonstrating one of the Florida State Theater back in Tallahassee. And I remember, if anybody goes back now, look at those years. Think about Martin Luther King and his leadership. They were in the middle of the summer demonstrating with white shirts, dark ties, a hat, and dress shoes. Why were they dressed that way? Was because not only were they dealing with the evils of Jim Crow laws, segregation, they're also understanding that there's basic racial stereotypes the Democrats were putting on the black race. They were going to ensure not only that other people respect us and not expect that, but also our kids knew that we weren't what they were saying that we were. Those stereotypes are very simple. It was lazy, slouchy, inarticulate, criminality, undisciplined, all those things. And unfortunately, we begin to see it. We're seeing those same stereotypes in our community today because the message is going to our kids every single day through the media. Black entertainment television, you look at that, it's nothing but negative stereotyping. So you wonder why these kids all of a sudden making millions of dollars and they step on the sideline and they do not have respect for the flag or respect for women or respect for whatever our country is about. They have not been taught that for 20 years because of what's going on behind the curtains. So it's we've had our generation before us understood the fight was not just the physical. It was the emotional and the perception, and we need to get back to making sure our kids and all Americans really recognize that we truly are, we're kids of a king. We should expect the best out of life and not listen to those who are going to put us down.
Well, true, and we have to do our own homework. We cannot, and any black person who recognizes that this tax bill that was passed today and will be signed into law will not benefit them. For the amount of people that have so-called been polled to say that they don't want a tax cut, how many people will go to work and their boss says, I'm going to give you a raise, and you say, no, I don't want that? So we're going to listen to Nancy Pelosi that says that this tax cut is so bad that you're going to get more money in your pocket and be able to save for your family and have more discretionary income, and you're going to say, no, don't give that to me? So this is the control mentality that the Democrats have had over the minority population, particularly the black population, for far too long. And unfortunately for the Democrats, they take the black votes for granted. The only time the Black Lives Matter is when they come for a vote, and then they disappear. So you're going to tell me for a single parent that's struggling that a tax cut is not going to help that individual where they have an increase of income to come in, and Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer is going to say, no, we don't want that for you. And the black community is supposed to listen to this and believe in this. That's why it's so important for us to be educated, for us to do our homework, for us to do our own research and not be spoon-fed the negative information that's being provided to us, because the same hand that's feeding you can also poison you.
And to go to that point, education has always, always been the key to freedom. It's no question about it. That's where the critical thinking comes from. That's where you can all of a sudden begin to think outside the box and not wait for somebody else to do it for you. I think it's really key. I wanted to share one other story with you that, and I call it tough men. It's tough is what men do. And it was actually an example of watching my dad. Back in Tallahassee, we used to go to Houston, Texas, every summer. And this is in the days when there was Jim Crow law. So we had in a restaurant at the service station, there was a white woman and a white man on the side restrooms, and in the back that's colored. Well, my parents never acquiesced to that, and would go into the white women and white men based on what they wanted, based was going in. Well, we had this one stop. And my mom was in the restroom, and these two young guys came in and started trying to knock the door down. My dad got out immediately and had an altercation with both of them. The end result, my mom did not have to come out of the restroom early, and my dad showed his two boys and three girls how real men act. And it's important to understand that the decision he made to act wasn't made on the spot. He made the decision once in his life. He was going to respect women. He's going to fight for women. He's going to do his best, whatever it might take, to make sure that his wife was going to be protected. So he didn't look at the options of this two against one. He didn't look at what would happen if they take me to jail. He made a decision once. And we need to make those decisions once, guys, in our lives. Make a decision we're going to succeed. Make a decision that we're not going to allow anyone to put our kids down or negate our race or use us to move their agenda forward. We make that decision, and then we just get better at recognizing when those opportunities come. So it's again, it was a great lesson for me. And over life, I've had a chance to, when I don't act as courageous as I want to, I say, well, next time I'm going to do a lot better, and that's the way it all works out. Any other samples for us?
Also, not to allow yourself to be manipulated.
Yes.
You have to be informed and have an open mind to receive information. And it starts with self-respect, respecting yourself and respecting others as well. There's no other ethnic group that can be taken for granted like the black population has. All other ethnic groups are focused on building wealth, improving their communities, advancing by gaining power of influence with public policy decisions, or building legacy for their families and passing that knowledge on through education to empower the next generation. Well, if that's going to be the focus and the focal point, then you will be more empowered to make a better decision for your family, yourself, and for future generations. And that's where the rubber hits the road. If you continue to be manipulated or defined by somebody else and controlled by someone else, then you will never be empowered to make those choices on your own like your father did for you.
Well, Jennifer, we're going to end up closing this out, but I really do appreciate your example. I think at the end of the day, we're going to start having more and more conservatives to stand for the right and have the courage to make sure that we let people know that this is where it's all about. This is what we need to get done. I'm going to go ahead and give out the number one more time, 1-800-941-SEAN, 1-800-941-7326. Okay, gang, Burgess Owens again and for Sean Hannity. Let me give you a number real quick. Once again, it's 1-800-941-SEAN or 1-800-941-7326. And we have a couple minutes. Let's go ahead and take a break with Jim. Jim, love to chat with you. What's your question?
Mr. Owen, I so appreciate your views. Thank you. It's an honor and a privilege. My question is, and those views of your guests, by the way, wonderful to hear.
Thank you.
My question is very simple. Do you think, given your circle of influence and your circle of friends, that the rise in the black conservative movement is something we're going to see grow and gain power? Or, unfortunately, would it be quelled by the old stereotypical Uncle Tom garbage?
Great, great question. I have never been more excited about what I'm seeing out there and across our country. And I'll say this. First of all, I understand there's 28% of black Americans who have conservative values, even though 93% of us voted for Democrats in the past. The greatest present of Obama was his in-your-face liberalism and his failure to deliver. Real quick, there is an increase of blacks on welfare, 58% over the last 8 years, decrease in home ownership for blacks, down 9.1%, decrease in black medium income. I can go on forever. Now, what's happened is that black Americans are waking up, and they're beginning to hear that that there's a better way, because they've experienced what's happened the last 8 years. And I tell you, in terms of the Uncle Tom thing, that's gotten a little old. For those of us who don't care about it, keep it right on. Keep it up. I mean, at the end of the day, we're going to give the message to those who want to hear it. And I'm not trying to convince those who are Marxists and socialists. I want to convince those who have the same values I do. They love our country, but they might be voting differently. They might even call themselves liberal. But they will vote the right values and principles, and we will end up pushing our community ahead. So, no, get ready for a sea change. 15, 20, 25% over the coming years of black Americans who will begin to demand both parties pay attention. And I'm going to love it, because that's what it's all about. It's not demanding respect, it's commanding respect. And let's go out there and win big time. Let's succeed. Let's teach our kids that this country is the greatest place in the history of mankind. And we do that, and we'll be in a good shape. All right?
Family, have a Merry Christmas. Thank you, sir.
Okay. Thank you, guys. Well, listen, just real quick before we go to the break here, again, for those who want to call in, it's 1-800-941-SEAN, 1-800-941-7326. On the other side, we're going to have Colonel Allen West, a true guy that I really have a lot of respect for, a hero of mine. So look forward to seeing you on the other side. See you in a little bit. Welcome back, everyone. Again, this is the Sean Hannity Show. My name is Burgess Owens, former NFL player with the Jets and Raiders, and now happy to be part of the bigger team. Let's make America great again. You can reach us here at the number 1-800-941-SEAN or 1-800-941-7326. I'm really looking forward to introduce my next guest, someone that I've watched for years and have respected his views, his courage. It's Allen West, Colonel Allen West, the former U.S. Congressman, Army veteran, and author of The Guardian of the Republic. I also want to give another little shout out from my home state of Florida, because Allen was also also the very first African-American Republican congressman from the state of Florida since 1876. So, again, Florida is hanging pretty tough right now, for sure, for sure. So, Alan, are you there?
I'm here, and it's good to be with you, Burgess. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas, my friend, for sure. You know, you have a very unique position, you and Mia Love, as being the only two black Republicans that's been part of the Congressional Black Caucus. So I wanted to kind of get a little insight from you in terms of what goes on behind closed doors. And a couple of my questions are going to be kind of light, and then I'm going to get into policies. But first of all, kind of give me an idea of the district that you represented, the Florida's 22nd district in the House, so we can get an idea what kind of people were voting for you for that position.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was interesting because in 1961, when I was born, Florida's 22nd District, which runs along the coast from Fort Lauderdale all the way up through Palm Beach Island to Jupiter Inlet, blacks were not allowed on the beach at Fort Lauderdale. And then 50 years later, when I was sworn in, I was the congressional representative of Fort Lauderdale, of Fort Lauderdale Beach in that area, and to include the, I think it was how they put it, the per capita income highest per capita income zip code, which is Palm Beach Island. So, you know, I had Mar-a-Lago was in the district, and got to meet President Trump, you know, several times, and had events at Mar-a-Lago. Rush Limbaugh was a constituent, Ann Coulter. So it was a district that was 92% to 93% white, but that did not matter because what they were looking for were content of character, not color of skin.
And that is actually where I was getting to. It's amazing because I did look it up to get an idea of just what kind of area. And it's pretty reflective of a lot of America, educated, middle class, and up, diverse. And of course, they voted for you for your values, your background, your ability to articulate yourself, your history, and your courage. Now, that being said, I have a question. What is it about white liberal Democrats that can never, ever, ever vote for a black person to represent them in Congress? Is there something I'm missing on this one? Because it seems like every liberal black only is relegated to work to represent only poor, uneducated, angry, and rioting the crime-ridden communities. And this, that doesn't seem to me to be a very inclusive way of looking at it.
Well, it's not an inclusive way of looking at it. And if you go back to the turn of the century, it is the Great Separation, because you had Booker T. Washington, who I call the father of black conservatism, who, when he established Tuskegee Institute, he believed in three principles: education, entrepreneurship, and self-reliance. And it was white liberal progressives who started the NAACP. And, of course, they put W.E.B. Du Bois in charge of the NAACP to counter all that Booker T. Washington was doing and what he stood for. And, of course, before the establishment of the NAACP, Du Bois and Washington were friends. They were comrades. But what the people that founded the NAACP wanted was a different direction. And therefore, you started to hear people later on in history talk about Booker T. Washington being a sellout or an Uncle Tom or, you know, some of those other disparaging names. Because it is all about relegating people to, and I'll be very honest, an economic plantation, and to not, you know, putting forth and advocating the policies of education, entrepreneurship, and self-reliance, which if you look at our inner city communities, look at how they've been decimated by the policies of the progressive socialist left.
Well, I tell you, first of all, that the NAACP has been quite an education to see who those people were. I'm going to talk about that in the next segment, but I think people will be surprised at where that came from and how the policies remain the same, even though it's a different color now it's running it. I'm going to another real light question. This is, what is behind closed doors? there are certain things, I guess, black lingo that I'm hearing from the black politicians, and I just want to get your idea. Is this something that they talk to each other this way behind closed doors? Things like stay woke. Now, my interpretation of stay woke, if we're going to translate that to white language, is being engaged, be educated, communicate yourself. But these guys use stay woke as a way to communicate. Now, here's another one. It's a great one here, and I don't know what this should be interpreted as. Emmanuel Cleaver, in front of millions of people in the National Convention, said this: she won't be throwed. Now, he repeated over and over again and almost dropped the mic because of standing ovation from this white crowd. She won't be thrown. So I'm wondering, number one, is there is they do to talk to each other like this behind closed doors, or is there a reason why the black politicians use this eubonic language to communicate what they're trying to get accomplished?
Well, I have to tell you, I really don't understand it. I don't know if they're playing to a certain crowd and playing to a certain image. But I will tell you that when I was there, Emanuel Cleaver was the chairman of the Congressional Black Caucus, and he and I developed a pretty good relationship because he knew he could come to me and I would give him an honest assessment and opinion, even though I was, you know, a conservative and I was from Florida. He knew that he could trust me not to play politics with him. And I'll give you a case in point. He came to me and asked me what would I think about, you know, the Congressional Black Caucus bringing Louis Farrakhan to Capitol Hill. And I told him, you know, if I could answer as a Republican and say, sure, go right ahead and do it. And, of course, I would slam him for that and, you know, make sure that he got all the negative publicity. But I told him, do you really want to bring that dark specter onto you? And of course, I would not agree with him in any way, shape, form, or fashion. And Chairman Cleaver ended up, you know, rescinding the invitation to Farrakhan to come up there. So he did trust my opinion and assessment. We worked together to make sure that the Montford Point Marines, the first black Marines, were awarded the Congressional Gold Medal, and we had an incredible ceremony recognizing that. But there is something about how many of the African-American representatives that are on the Democrat side somewhat advocate the policies of the left because they want to stay in position, because they want to be able to stay in that congressional seat or that senatorial seat that they have and not really advocate the policies that do better for them. Or as in the case of Emanuel Cleaver, who was an ordained minister, they're voting contrary to the principles that he was speaking about in the pulpit.
And that's actually the point I was going to get to next, because obviously what we're there to do, the goal is not only to represent our country, but we have constituents. We're trying to do the very best. And there's certain policies that have really harmed the black community in so many different ways. And I wanted you to, if you could just list, you say your top three or four policies that you think have made that destructive pathway. And if there was any giveaway or any communication, any kind of debating with the black congressional Congress within behind closed doors, as if this could, these policies could be changed because they were hurting our communities.
Well, the first one I would say, you go back to the Great Society programs of Lyndon Johnson, and when he said that a woman that has a child out of wedlock will receive a check from the government, with the caveat being she couldn't have a man in the home. You know, when I was born in 1961, and I'm sure it's the same, you're just a couple of days older than I am, but, you know, the two-parent household in the black community was between 75% and 77%. From that point, 1965 moving forward, now we see that the two-parent household in the black community is down to about 24%. I think that when you destroy that basic foundation of the community, which was strong mother and a strong father, it's had incredible negative adverse ramifications in the black community. The second thing is the stance of the progressive socialist left and many of these African-American representatives that do not agree with school choice, any voucher program, or anything that competes against the standard of the National Education Association and the American Federation of Teachers, the teachers' unions. And so I think that, again, not being able to have quality education in the inner-city communities have really been detrimental. And the last thing comes back to, you know, tax policies and economic policies and the lack of, you know, small business development and entrepreneurship in our inner city communities, which is completely different from when I was growing up. And you walk down Auburn Avenue and you see all kinds of small business and entrepreneurship. So I think that those are the three things: the family, the education, and then also the economic opportunities. And I think that it comes down to these two different things. It's the difference between the equality of opportunity and the equality of outcomes. The progressive socialist left is all about the equality of outcomes. And what we're trying to do as constitutional conservatives is talk about the equality of opportunity.
Well, you know, I tell you, as we're going through that, there's certain things that I have come to be really passionate about. And I guess the first thing is we need to see courage, leadership. It concerns me when we have people supposedly supporting or representing us that literally stand strongly with passion against everything that would be right for the people they're supposed to be representing. And I have to believe that these guys are smart enough to see the numbers, to see that our community is trending in the wrong way for certain policies, and to know that things like school choice, how can any black man or woman, by that matter, ever vote against anything that would keep our race, anyone in our race, poor, young, it doesn't matter, not illiterate, not educated. And those are things that I just have a very, very difficult thing coming to. And again, I think it's going to come to conservatives being strong enough and confident enough to make sure that we can get the message out to people who have trusted these guys, that we now need to change course and do another thing. Now, Alan, I'd like to get an idea. When you think about what you think would make our community great again, you again, grew up during a time, had parents that really taught you some mm-hmm. basic themes of what it to be a success. You grew up in military families. What do you think mm-hmm. would it take to get us back to that type of environment to once again be look at ourselves, be proud of our future and where our kids are going?
Well, first of all, you bring up a great point. We need to have true principled leadership and not the charlatans that we see. When I look at someone like a Maxine Waters, who is now a millionaire, doesn't even live in the district that she supposedly represents, and talking about issues, you know, impeachment of President Trump when that's not important for the people of her district. And as a matter of fact, there was a report that just came out this week that talks about how black unemployment, you know, in this year under President Trump is at a 17-year low. So it didn't occur with President Obama, where we saw the highest amount of black unemployment. It has occurred with President Trump. So we need to have principled leadership. I think the other thing is important to restore the sanctity of a two-parent family, especially with positive black male role models. We have to restore that sense of respect and regard for authority in the black community, much the same as it was when I was growing up. And we have to convey a message that, you know, growing up to stay in Section 8 housing and expecting a check from the government, that's not the new normal. That's not the way of life. You have to want to have greater and better. My father was a corporal in World War II. My older brother was a Lance Corporal, United States Marine Corps in Vietnam. And I will never forget, as long as I live, when at the age of 15, my dad set me down on the steps of 651 Kennesaw, which is in the same old Fourth Ward neighborhood that gave us Dr. Martin Luther King. And he challenged me to be the first officer in our family. And that's what strong families do, and that's what strong, positive black male role models do for their sons. And also they set an incredible example for the daughters as well. And that's what we need to have happen.
And to that point, I was asked earlier if I see a trend of blacks beginning to kind of open up and look at other options and begin to have conversations. Do you see a trending at all, based on where we are now and based on even the policies that have now been put in place with President Trump, a trending toward getting the black community thinking again about what they've been told and possibly becoming more conservative or at least becoming more independent? Do you see that happening at all?
Yeah, I do see some of that happening when I'm out traveling, and you even have young African-Americans that come up and say, hey, you know, I know who you are, and we appreciate you having a different perspective, and, you know, I learn from you. But the key thing for the Republican Party, if I can come back to party politics, is that they have to stop believing in what, you know, they call outreach, which means they show up in February in Black History Month, and they do all the, you know, the circuit, and then no one ever sees them again until 60 days before an election. They have to have what I call policy engagement. They have to talk about the things that we're saying here. They have to talk about the difference in their belief of the strength of the family, the small business entrepreneurship, the education, all of these basic fundamental conservative values. My parents were registered Democrats. My parents voted for John Lewis when I was growing up there in Atlanta.
Alan, we're kind of coming against a heartbreak. I want to thank you, my friend, for your courage, for your leadership. Literally, sure. I'm glad to be on the same team with you, my friend. And Merry Christmas. Have a great one, okay?
Merry Christmas.
All right.
Take care, man. Bye-bye.
Just everybody, here's the numbers once again before we go into break. 1-800-941-SEAN or 1-800-941-7326. And we're going to end up having Sheriff David Clark coming up. So stay with us, guys. Talk to you a little bit. This is Burgess Owens again for the Sean Hannity Show. Let me give you a real quick number here so you can call in. 1-800-941-SEAN or 1-800-941-7326. My next guest, if I said the two words, the sheriff, I think we'll all know who I'm talking about, right? David Clark, former sheriff of Milwaukee County. We have a great topic coming at you.
This is CNN.
Apparently, the president gets two scoops. You know, everyone around the table gets one. And no word if there were sprinkles.
At the dessert course, he gets two scoops of vanilla ice cream with his chocolate cream pie instead of the single scoop for everyone else.
I would be remiss if I did not ask you both about the hand swat seen around the world.
It wasn't even a complete sentence tweeted out by President Trump just after midnight. Despite the constant negative press, what's that word?
Kafifi.
Huh?
Kafifi. Kafifi.
Professionals could only guess at how to pronounce it. We're pretty sure the president meant to type negative press coverage, but the Kafifi tweet stayed up for almost 6 hours.
A case of chivalry? Or a phobia, a theory about why President Trump grabbed the British Prime Minister's hand, now getting the thumbs down. CNN's Jeannie Most explains all this.
Whether it be not shaking the German Chancellor's hand or clutching the hand of Britain's Prime Minister, President Trump's hands seem to end up in headlines. For instance, the BBC headline, Donald Trump is scared of stairs. Staircase, chortled one British paper back when President Trump took Prime Minister May's hand as they navigated a ramp at the White House. Bathmophobia, a fear of ramps and stairs.
Hello, everyone. We're back again with the Sean Hannity Show. My name is Burgess Owens, a former NFL player with the Jets and Raiders, now a happy and proud member of the Let's Make America Great Again team. So welcome back. You hear a little bit of the funny fake news, and it would be very funny if it wasn't so serious, but we're going to talk about that a little bit with our next guest. If I said the two words, the sheriff, I think you probably know what I'm talking about. It's David Clark, former sheriff of Milwaukee County, author of Cop Under Fire, Moving Beyond Hashtags of Crime, Race, Crime, and Politics for a Better America. David, welcome. How you doing, my friend?
Burgess, it's great to be on with you. Hello to your listeners, and Merry Christmas.
Same to you, David. Well, listen, I wanted to, you had an article that really got my attention. It's called Liberal Politics and Media Fuel Milwaukee Riots. And this came out a little bit after the riots in your area. President Trump has branded the mainstream media as fake news. And I think Americans are beginning to recognize that there is some collusion with the mainstream, and there's a specific end game. It's very targeted. It portrays those who trust them, and in old days we used to call it propaganda. But with the article you wrote, kind of can you give an idea of some of the highlights of the politics and media that helped fuel those riots? Because obviously the message was already given for that incident to happen to take off the way it did.
Sure, and let me unpack that for a little bit because there's a couple moving parts. First of all, as it relates to the liberal media, they've abandoned their responsibility under the First Amendment to be a government watchdog and to not take sides. And as you indicated, Burgess, they become the propaganda machine for liberal politics, liberal policies, and the Democrat Party. And I think it's at a detriment to the entire nation. Now, as it relates to failed urban policies that I talked about then that continue to plague the black community, some of this is what ails the black community is self-inflicted. When you have a father of kids from multiple women and you don't raise those kids and you don't take on the responsibility of being a dad, that hurts. Mm-hmm. When you don't stay consistently in the workforce to build up a resume and a history so you can go on and move up in the income ladder with a better job, that hurts. When you drop out of school and don't take education seriously, those are the things that I mentioned that are self-inflicted. When you make questionable lifestyle choices like join a gang or use and abuse alcohol and drugs, you're only going to hurt yourself. However, some of those things have been fueled by failed liberal policies. One of them is the economy's been sluggish in many of these urban centers where people can't find meaningful work. The schools, the K-12 public schools, are abysmal. Even the kids who are going there on a consistent basis are not really being educated. There's no learning going on. It's liberal indoctrination. When you see crime levels in many of these neighborhoods where good, peaceful blacks are just trying to make it through life, raise their kids, so on and so forth, because of crime policies that have failed, you know, this revolving door that's been created, you know, where they won't lock up for significant periods of time to change behavior. They won't lock up career criminals. They keep slapping them on the wrist, finding excuses for their abhorrent behavior. So, you know, it's a volatile mix. And when you put those two things together, you're going to end up with what we see in many urban centers. And this thing continues to plague the black community.
And I tell you, what I've come to realize is that this is not new. This whole strategy of fake news is something that actually came after our race back in 1910. I wanted to share this with you real quickly. Then I have some questions for you in terms of where the source might be today in 2017. A lot of people don't realize that back in 1910, the black community was one of the most competitive communities in our country. I mean, I went through some of those things a little bit earlier. And that was the same year that the NAACP was founded. And for those who don't know, it stands for National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. The only problem is there's no colored people involved in any part of it, founding it or controlling it. The NAACP was founded by 21 white, wealthy, socialist, Marxist, atheist, eugenics, race control Democrats. Now, the only difference today, it is now black, white, socialist, Marxist, atheist, race-controlled Democrats, but the policy is all the same. And you mentioned some of those things that are right now plaguing our inner city, the school no school choice, no ways of getting jobs because of minimum wage, those kind of things. So we have I guess a couple of issues. Number one, it's almost becoming an intergenerational radicalization or indoctrination. So we have to get back and get our young people thinking again. At the same time, we have to change these policies that will allow them to see the results of what's happened in the past. Based on the environment you were working in for 40 years or so, what would you say is the source within the urban community of this fake news? Because a lot of these kids or people in this arena are not looking at NBC or Fox News. So what would you say is where this perception or self-view is coming from?
Well, the liberal media, you know, they're the purveyors of this fake news, and it's led to, it's done to mislead. It's done to steer people astray. For over a half century, as you indicated, 1910 all the way through up to about 1950, blacks were industrious. They came north looking for work. They didn't come north from the South when it changed from an agricultural-based economy to the Industrial Revolution. They came north looking for money because that's where the Industrial Revolution broke out. They had intact families, very religious people, took care of their kids, raised their kids, worked hard in spite of some great odds with Jim Crow in the South and even in aspects of keeping them out of the labor force in the North. But they overcame that because they were industrious, like I said. They had an ability to overcome obstacles. They thought for themselves. The fake news, as you know, Burgess, is designed to, like I said, lead people astray. So we had a half century, let's say, from the 1950s all the way up until the year 2000, where you see all of this propaganda. The NAACP has lost its way. They've abandoned their mission of being a fighter for civil rights for all Americans, and they become a lapdog for the Democrat Party. So they sit up there, and they're used to come out and call out Whitey. They're used to come out and play the race card, and I think that it's been, as a detriment to everybody, to all Americans. So, but the fake news has been unmasked, all right? And but for Donald Trump, who took that liberal media on, and he fought back and he pushed back. He did something that your career politicians were afraid to do. All the people in Washington, they're afraid of the media. So when the media slaps them around, they just take it. Donald Trump pushed back, exposed them for what they were doing, and it was fake news. This stuff was all, for the most part, is all made up. And like I said, that's an example of how the liberal media has abandoned their First Amendment responsibility.
Well, and I'll say this, I truly do believe that the ideologies of Marxism and socialism, there's just no good in it. And basically, it's ideal of stealth. And to the idea of an NAACP, a lot of people don't realize that the first president was white. As a matter of fact, they didn't get the black president for 65 years after it began. In 1918, the anti-lynching law was put together by the Republican Party. Guess who stood against it the first year? The president of the NAACP. They finally changed their ways, but you got to understand, this is the mentality and the stealth that has been going on for a long, long time, and its betrayal of a group that, again, a lot of good people have done within that organization, have paid the price, but it's the leadership that we had to look at over the time and what their ultimate goal was. There's also one other thing I want to mention that I think people might not realize. When I talk about the competitive nature of our times, there's something called the Davis-Bacon Act that was put together, yep, the only race that ever a Congress put together a law to keep us from competing, the Davis-Bacon Act in 1932. So what do you think, Dave, when you think about how we're going to get over this, how we're going to move on and make our communities great again, what would you say would be a few key points to make that work?
Yeah, before I get to that, I want to touch on this Bacon-Davis Act or Davis-Bacon Act. I'm familiar with it. It was designed to keep black people out of the trades, the better paying jobs during the start of the Industrial Revolution when blacks came north looking for work. That's how they did it. And of course, that was Democrat led. That was labor organization, organized labor led. Well, what's going to happen, Burgess, is first of all, the Democrats, the Democrat Party, the liberals, the socialists, they're all one and the same. They're going to have to get their boot off our neck so that we can stand up on our own two feet and become self-sufficient, start to think for ourselves, start to hold ourselves accountable. One of the things that goes on, and I think to the detriment of the black community, is there's this unwritten rule that you can't self-criticize. In other words, no black could say anything about Barack Obama, even though his policies led to a growing unemployment among blacks. It led to a decrease in home ownership. But if you just said something as simple as, you know, I disagree with President Barack Obama's economic policies, and you were a black person, they came down on you like a ton of bricks. You know, you were a sellout. You were this, you were that. And that's that self-criticism. You know, we're not all perfect. And so until we are able to take a look in the mirror and start with ourselves and see and say to ourselves and ask ourselves, what can we do better? Not what can somebody can do for me. What can we do better to affect a different outcome in terms of all of these pathologies that go on in our community? And so until we're able to do those things, self-criticize and hold each other accountable, hold ourselves accountable, it's going to be very difficult. But I think it starts with, like I said, Democrats, Democrat Party, the liberals, socialists, to get their boot off our neck and let us stand on our own two feet.
Well, I tell you, the first time you said that, I almost stood up and applauded, but I withheld myself. But it's right, so spot on, David. It really is. Well, listen, appreciate your voice. Appreciate your courage. We're on our way back. I tell you, black Americans and Americans realizing, number one, we don't want anybody's pity. We just want the opportunity to stand on our own, and we're going to get that done. So, David, thank you so much for your example. Keep it going, my friend. Merry Christmas.
Okay? I will. It's my pleasure, Burgess.
Okay, listen, guys. Again, our number is 1-800-941-SEAN, 1-800-941-7326. We look forward to seeing you on the other side and see if we'll take some questions when we do come back. Welcome back, everyone. Again, this is the Sean Hannity Show. This is Burgess Owens. We have about 3 minutes for our next break, so let me just jump real quick to a call. We have Wayne from Columbia, South Carolina. What's up, Wayne?
Hey, Mr. Owens. Thank you for taking my call. My question to you is, how do you sell conservatism to the average black people walking around? They seem so bent on being Democrats. 15 years ago, my life was in shambles, and conservatism basically saved my life. It made me responsible. It made me care about my civic duties, and it made me want to raise my child in a way where she had a future. And I'm just wondering, since the policies of the Democrats really don't even serve black people, but for some reason they seem to vote that way in mass, how do we sell the ideology of conservatism to regular black people?
What a great question. What a great question. And I'll say this. What we get to do is live our lives, be confident, be bold. and let people know who we are. I mean, I think the biggest problem we have within our black communities, we have a lot of conservatives, but they're afraid to say they are. Well, it's now time for us to put our race, our family, and our country first. Be bold about who you are, guys. I mean, what else can they do other than call your name? And when I was taught when I was growing up, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words can never harm me. I still believe that. So let them call the names, but let's go ahead and recognize what you're saying right now is how we get our country back, one at a time, by example. And I can't say, I'll just say this, welcome aboard. If I had time, I can tell you my conversion story, because I too was once a Democrat and I realized it wasn't working. So welcome, buddy. All right. Congratulations. I'm proud of you. And we're going to get a lot more of Americans across the board to understand that the Judeo-Christian values that we believed in and our ancestors believed in are our way out. So we'll go ahead and go into the next break here. It's, again, the call here is 1-800-941-SEAN. 1-800-941-7326. Hey, gang, welcome back again. The Sean Hannity Show. My name is Burgess Owens. And let me give you a number real quick and call into 1-800-941-SEAN, 1-800-941-7326. We've had some really awesome guests, and I just appreciate it again, being within a circle of people that really have such a love for our country. I've been asking everybody at the end of the segment of what they thought it would take to bring our country back again, our community back again. And I want to share my thoughts. I want to share this segment with Clark Kellogg. Clark is He's a former NBA star with the Pacers. He's now presently a CBS sports analyst. And so you guys have heard his name and heard his voice. But he's also on the board of a project, an initiative called the One Heart Project. And I wanted to kind of chat about that for a quick second. Before I bring Clark on, I just want to do this quickly. How did I get to where I am today of having this passion and finding, I think, a way to make a difference? My search began about 30 years ago when I retired from the NFL. My goal at the point, you've heard about my past great community. My goal was to some kind of way bring that back because I saw our trajectory going in the wrong direction. And my dad and I spent hours upon hours over the last 20 years discussing a type of model that would do that to help kids as young as third grade, for instance, to develop critical thinking skills, to have an interest in science, from agriculture to marine science. And now, he passed without having a chance to finish up. He had a great impact, but he did not have a chance to see his dream scaled out. Last year, I was visiting a juvenile correction center down in Tampa, Florida, and I spent a couple hours with about 50, 60 young men. We're talking about second chances, entrepreneurship, and attitudes. And I was really asked a question that was pretty profound by one of the young men. He said, Burgess, once we leave here, you know, how do we put this behind us? You know, we have a record now. We have to go back to the community with no jobs, no education. How do we leave this behind us? And he was so sincere. I knew what he was trying to ask me. You've given us some hope. Now, how do we keep it? And actually, I didn't have an answer to that, to be honest with you. Obviously, you want to have a positive attitude, but how do you answer that? Well, earlier this year, I ended up flying to Indianapolis to sit in and observe the opening of one of the chapters of One Heart Project. I had heard about it and decided I'd just go up and listen in. And sitting there over the next couple of days, I realized that this is exactly what my dad and I have been discussing for decades, only on steroids. And we have chapters now in Dallas and Indianapolis and Kansas. And the goal, very simply, is to take what the liberals have discarded and turn it into our national treasures. And these young boys and girls who have just not had an opportunity to really understand how special they are and what they can do. So I've invited Clark. He's on the national board of the One Heart Project. I wanted to bring on board real quick. Clark, how you doing, buddy?
I'm good, Burgess. Great to be with you this evening.
Well, listen, I really enjoyed talking with you when we talked a little recently. And you know what I thought would be good? First of all, I'd ask you to do something for me. That is, how did you become aware of this? And it didn't just start at one point. It was a process. How did you become aware of the program, and what is it about it that kind of brought the empathy of you to wanting to connect with these young people?
Well, you know, Steve Rich is the chairman of the board for the One Heart Project and actually founded a nonprofit organization called the Heart of a Champion, which basically revolved around character education, life skills education geared towards juveniles, those who were at risk, in terms of trying to change their direction. And being one who's enjoyed the benefits of athletic competition and education through athletics and a solid lower middle income class upbringing, I saw that this was an opportunity to maybe give kids a second chance that maybe have gone astray. So really back in the late 90s, I became aware of the Heart of a Champion, which again was mentoring programs, life skills development programs, character development programs geared towards helping our young people realize their potential. And out of that One Heart, that Heart of a Champion Foundation's work, came the One Heart Project Initiative, which is about reentry and redirection for incarcerated youth and at-risk youth to give these young folks a sense of hope. And again, through tried and true programs around character development, life skills development, also the positive impact caring adults can have on this community. And you combine and partner with local and national service organizations, Burgess, and connect people with a heartbeat for our young folks to try to redirect and reorient them, those who have gone astray and those who are at risk, to give them an opportunity to feel hope, to see hope, and to embrace hope for what their future can be.
And I'll tell you, that sums that, that word hope is a remarkable feeling. And, you know, many of us have no idea what it feels like not to have it. But there are people who live this way every single day of their lives, not knowing what the next day. Matter of fact, in the on the video, one of the guys that was introduced is a young man named Mac, who was in his late teens. And he had no hope of making it past 21 years old, because that's basically what he saw around him. So how has it worked out so far in terms of the actual success? I mean, have you had a chance to see?
Oh, man, I tell you, it's amazing the impact and the change of direction that can happen. Again, it's a combination of a lot of people. Obviously, the One Heart Project initiative has been embraced by a number of folks across the country. Over 25 states now have some form of the One Heart Project in place. Thousands and thousands of young kids have been impacted in a positive way, and that continues as this initiative grows. But you see, Mac White is a case in point, a guy who was being released from the juvenile prison system, had no idea how to go about finding work, changing direction, and through mentoring, character development, life skills development, connecting him to resources in his community, he's now gone on to become a positive, productive, contributing member of society. And that is duplicated across the country in terms of hundreds of at-risk kids and also those who have maybe already entered into the juvenile system.
Well, one of the things that I found really interesting, again, it's all about measurability also. We want to make sure that these ideas are working. And I'll just say this also. We talk about the fact that 70% of these young men and women do not have fathers. Well, the ones that find themselves in this environment being locked up, there's 85% of them that are fatherless. At the same time, the recidivism rate normally in the traditional world is 70%. Well, with One Heart, it's down to 18%. So I'm very, very excited about that. And let me just do this real quick while I have you, because I wanted you to introduce yourself in that way of turning the background, because I want people to realize that this is what we're all about. It's we, the people. It's you. You know, Clark, you're a black guy. Well, Rich is a white guy.
Yep.
When I go back to, I talked about the Underground Railroad, my great-great-grandfather, who was black, but he was helped out by Mexican and Germans. That is what we do. We do things together. And it's all because of the foundation that's made our country great, the Judeo-Christian values that help us see each other from inside out, not outside in. And that's one thing that we'll have to, as a country, really recognize. And Evita King mentioned it. We are truly one race. And once we really understand that, then we recognize that what other people feel, we could be feeling the same way if we're in the same situation. So it's important to recognize that and move forward. Let me ask you, what exactly, was there anything particularly that you have dealt with in your past that kind of helped you also to see this process happen?
No question about it, Burgess. I mean, all of us have challenges and struggles throughout our journey, no matter how successful we appear to be, whether it's friends or family or extended family. And this hits home really close for me, because my dad was a policeman in Cleveland, where I grew up for over 40 years. He worked in the juvenile unit as a young police officer, and I got to see some guys in my community that were going the wrong direction be positively impacted by a program called the Police Athletic League at the time, where police officers and the community would rally around juveniles that maybe were at risk, that perhaps were heading down the wrong road and would be able to be redirected through the caring of adults, caring of police officers. And One Heart Project is much like that. I've got a younger brother who's had some major issues throughout his life as a result of being led astray. And so it's hit home from the standpoint of family, but also just in our communities. You see it happen so often where kids maybe not having the same foundation, the same direction in terms of under their roof, and then they get involved in the community and go astray. And then you've heard stories, and I've seen great testimonies of folks that because there were adult people that cared, that showed them another direction. And it's regardless of race, income level, class. Again, to your point, and you articulated it so well, seeing each other from the inside out, recognizing that values are timeless, principles for success are timeless, the things that are needed, love and concern and compassion and offering hope and a second chance, those are things that we can all do. That's not something that one population or one particular group of people have a market on. That's a call and responsibility for all of us to take and be engaged in and involved in, especially as it relates to our young folks who are going to become the leaders of the future. What are we doing to invest in their growth, in their development, and in their chances for success?
And I tell you, hitting that point, what are we doing to invest in? And I want to say this, because what has made us so unique again as a country is that it's more than just feeling sorry for people. Our country has always been one of service. We go out and we roll up our sleeves. We figure out how can we help? How can we be part of it? And that, and in that process, we actually fall in love with each other because we're helping. We see ourselves in a better way, and those who are being helped begins to appreciate us in a different way. So it is again, more of a program than just throwing money. The programs we're going to need, the way we're going to change our country in the future, is basic understanding that we need to make sure that our kids have the same hopes, the same vision, the same belief that their future will be as great as we thought when we came through. That is our responsibility. And if we fall short of that, I don't care how rich and wealthy we become, if we do not allow our kids to stand on our shoulders and move forward with even better opportunities and means, then we've failed. And this is why I'm so excited about the folks that we've talked about throughout this day. And I do want to leave this, say this with you too, because I wanted to have you on here when I mentioned this. Clark lives in Columbus, Ohio, and it just so happens I was born in Columbus, Ohio. Now, this gives you an idea, this kind of gives you an idea of the greatness of our last generation and what our new generation is now doing that is really making a difference. Clark actually works on the board of one of the boards of Ohio State. If I'm correct.
That's correct. Yes, sir. I'm on the board of trustees of Ohio State, my alma mater, which I'm extremely proud of.
Well, let me tell you why we were in Columbus, Ohio. My dad had come back from the war, and he wanted to get his PhD. And down south in Tallahassee, that was illegal. It was Jim Crow laws. It could not do it. I ran across papers after he passed away of he and his my uncle, all papers across the country of rejection letters. They finally, and it was because of the ranking that in a school at Fairview, I knew what it was. It was all about the race. They were accepted by Ohio State. So my dad got his PhD in agronomy. My uncle got his PhD in economics. I was born in Ohio, and I probably would have tried to go to school there, but I realized being a Florida boy, it's too cold to try to play football there, so I didn't even consider it. But my point is this. Our race in the past, the people, the generation, black and white, they were winners. They weren't whiners, weenies, and wimps. They didn't complain. Not once did my parents tell me about the trip from Texas to Ohio and the struggles they had or the rejection they had. They just talked about the power of winning and moving on and having a great life after that. And now we have here in 2016 black people that have proven themselves, proven value, and now on the board of trustees at Ohio State, which we all respect, whether we are for them or against them, we respect them. And that's how far we've come, and that's why we have to make sure we understand this is the place that those kind of things can be done. This is the place of all places that we can dream big and it become a reality. So we're going to have to kind of close this out, Clark. I really appreciate you, buddy. I appreciate your efforts. I appreciate the friendship.
My pleasure, Burgess.
I appreciate the friendship you have with Rich. And at the end of the day, that's how we make things happen, okay? So thank you, buddy. Appreciate that very much. And we're going to go ahead and break one more time here. We have the numbers again for you guys. 1-800-941-SEAN. 1-800-941-SEAN. and Steve Rich is who I was talking about. So, okay, we'll see you on the other side. Okay, guys, we're back. Again, this is the Sean Hannity Show. My name is Burgess Owens. I can't say enough. This is going by so fast and such an exciting day it has been. Thank you so much for the Sean Hannity team. It's just awesome. The guys have done such a great job here. I also want to leave you real quickly how to catch up with me. My website is Burgess Owens, www.burgessowenstalks.com. My book, again, is the best Amazon bestseller, Liberalism, How to Turn Good Men into Whiners, Weenies, and Wimps. And I just wanted to say a couple words before we let you guys go. Number one, Al Davis said it best in terms of what America does. We know that we're in a fight. We now know we're in a fight, right, guys? So what do? We just win, baby. That's what we do. So let's get to it. My favorite saying, and I want everybody to keep this in mind as you, we all go through our struggles. We all go through those times. We just wonder when it's going to end. Keep this in mind. It all works out in the end. If it hasn't worked out yet, it's not the end. So keep that in mind, and that's the way our country will continue to grow. We're going to win this thing, my friends. We're waking up, and our values that we start off with will continue to support us and drive us as we teach our young what those values are. And once we do, there's nothing going to stop us. So I'm very, very excited about that. Have a merry, merry Christmas, gang. Let's enjoy it, and let's make this next year the best yet, okay? All the best. Take care. Talk to you later.